Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, November the 29th, 2021. And I'm joined here today with a returning and long-term guest, Virginia Latorre-Jeeker, who is a well-known U.S. tax lawyer based in Dubai. And I think that many of you have probably seen and learned a great deal from her blog over the years, which is at us-tax.org. How are you today, Virginia?
I'm doing great, John. I hope you are too, and you're not too cold in Canada.
It is not that cold at all in Canada, especially not in Toronto. But I do agree that it is an awful lot warmer in Dubai at any time of the year.
Well, don't be jealous. We've got about 80 degrees Fahrenheit or thereabouts.
Okay. Well, it's definitely colder here. And regardless of the weather, whether it's cold in Canada or warm in Dubai, the renunciations of U.S. citizenship go on and on. There's no question about that. And today our podcast, which is probably going to be fairly quick, is really prompted by a series of articles, which we found in various publications, talking about what's required to renounce U.S. citizenship. And our general view of this is that, you know, it's important to realize that renunciation is something that happens under the Immigration and Nationality Act. And that's separate from the Internal Revenue Code, but it is certainly true that renunciation can have important U.S. tax consequences, because we all know that the U.S. taxes only one thing, and that's everything. And as long as renunciation is something, it's open to U.S. taxation. Okay. Virginia, your comments specifically focusing on the difference between the immigration aspects and the tax aspects.
Right. I think people have to understand that when they are going to renounce their U.S. citizenship, their renunciation of the U.S. citizenship depends strictly on the immigration laws of the United States. And when the renunciation takes place, you have to go to a U.S. consulate or embassy outside of the United States in order to renounce. And you take what's called an oath of renunciation. That is the really litmus test for renouncing. When you are taking that oath, the consular official will make sure that you have completely understood what you are doing, that you are doing it voluntarily, and that you understand certain aspects of your renunciation that will impact the rest of your life. For example, that this is an act that is one you can't take back, okay? You can't change your mind tomorrow and say, I didn't mean to do it. That's not to say you can never become a U.S. citizen again, but you will have to go through the procedure that any foreigner may have to go through, getting a green card first, going through residency, and so forth and so on, and then applying for U.S. citizenship. So the immigration laws are designed to make sure essentially that your renunciation is voluntary and made with a full understanding of the consequences.
And intentional.
I'm sorry?
And the intention to sever ties.
Yes, that it's intentional and you are really doing this with the intent to renounce and that you understand what that means. So that's the immigration side, and it's quite simple to do. What I've been seeing in the articles I've been reading is a confusing people between their ability to renounce their U.S. citizenship from an immigration standpoint, which, as we've just discussed, is quite simple to do, and what the tax ramifications might be. And this is, I think, what you and I want to clarify today. So we can maybe go through some points that we've seen.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah, before moving over to the tax thing, though, if I can just add one thing and get your comments. So the legal test for renunciation is laid out in Section 349A of the Immigration Nationality Act, and it has to be voluntary, which is why, by the way, the State Department will not let lawyers be involved directly in the renunciation. I would also add that it's important that the communication surrounding the request for the renunciation appointment and that is probably best done by the person renouncing and not a third party. On the intention, it's interesting that the way they probe the intention sometimes is by asking specifically, do people know what they're giving up? And if you look at DS-4081, which is something that everybody has to fill out, there's a whole list of things, right? Which would include not being able to presumptively live in the United States, work in the United States, access U.S. consular services, or vote. So, I mean, those are some pointers. There are lots of people renouncing U.S. citizenship, and I certainly am not going to suggest that it's a completely stress-free process. But at the end of the day, people do have the right to renounce. And as long as the twin tests of voluntariness and intention are met, there would be no problem on that. Moving on.
One point we might want to mention here that goes directly to voluntary and intentional relinquishment deals with minors. So if you have someone that's a young person, quite often their parents are, you know, non-US people, and they're freaking out that the child just by happenstance may have been born in the States and is a US citizen, and they want to renounce child citizenship. And they are always very upset when I tell them they can't do that. The child has to be able to meet these tests of knowing intention and voluntary relinquishment. And the State Department policy is pretty much, you have to be at the age of majority to be able to meet those tests. Although I do know they may consider someone who is 17 years old as opposed to 18 years old, but they will probe far more deeply to see, was this renunciation going to be something that the child was pressured into doing by parents and so forth. I have never worked on a renunciation of anyone under the age of 18. The youngest I had was just about 18 and a couple of months. So, and he had no problem, by the way. But it does go directly to the issues of voluntariness and intentional relinquishment.
Yeah.
This business of being a minor.
Yeah, you know, the other group that is more likely to have problems would be people who are, I don't know how to put this, you know, extremely old. Yeah, extremely old. And, you know, perhaps moving into the area of Alzheimer's or something. I mean, I have had some experience with that as well. I've not yet had a situation where the renunciation was declined, but I have had situations where there was more than one consular officer interviewing the person, right? Which is a, you know, a clear sign of concern in that area.
Of course.
So
maybe
people
do have special challenges, such as the elderly or people that may have, you know, mental challenges.
Yeah.
For other reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why, you know, when I talk to people about this, particularly as they're in their 70s, you know, that's a point that I try to gently impress on them that, you know, as time goes on, you know, this type of stuff may raise more issues. But anyway, as a general principle, renunciation is not a big deal. It's not a problem. It might be worth distinguishing it, though, from other kinds of, you know, these backdated relinquishments where, you know, did somebody relinquish U.S. citizenship by becoming Canadian or something, you know, in the 1980s? Those can be, well, they are, to put it simply, much more difficult to achieve, much more difficult to achieve. But we've talked about that, I think, on other podcasts over the years. Okay, so renunciation. So if we imagine the U.S. government as two big bureaucracies, the State Department and the Treasury, the Internal Revenue Service. So now the question is, what impact might renunciation have on the whole tax issue? And I guess I would begin by asking this. In your experience, has anybody ever been, have any of your clients ever even been asked about tax compliance and things like that during a renunciation interview?
Some of them have been asked whether they have been filing tax returns. And I believe that is a question on one of the forms that the State Department asks you to fill out.
It's on the DS-4079. It's on the DS-4079.
Yes. Have you been filing tax returns, I believe, is the question.
Yeah, or do the question is, do you file U.S. tax returns? Do you?
Okay.
You know, in the present tense. But the DS-4079 is a form that was originally designed for another use, which was to allow people to use the word claim, right, or acknowledge, get acknowledgement from the State Department that they actually are U.S. citizens. You know, presumably the tax question being asked because if you didn't think you were a U.S. citizen, why would you be filing taxes? Sort of thing. But it's interesting how, you know, that form is now used for a different purpose for these backdated relinquishments.
Yes. But okay. People get worried when they see that question and there's no
need to get very worried. They get very worried.
You know, there's no need to be worried. I mean, someone may not have a duty to file tax returns because they simply don't have a duty. They don't work. They don't have any.
Well, or more to the point, if it's a backdated relinquishment, if you're claiming, you know, in a backdated relinquishment, you're going in there and saying, hey, I'm not a U.S. citizen. I want a certificate of loss of nationality. Why in God's name would you be filing U.S. tax returns if you weren't a U.S. citizen? You know, if they ask, of course I don't file. I'm not a U.S. citizen. That's why I'm here. Please give me my CLN.
So people should not worry when they see that question. But let's go on, John, to some of the other points we have seen in the articles that we have concerns, you know, with confusion to the readers. So one of the points we've seen is that it's stated you must hold citizenship of another country in order that you will not become stateless. As a matter of law, that's not correct, but I think as a matter of common sense, you do need a citizenship in order to be able to travel, for example, to have a passport. You do want the protection of some country in the event that you're in another country and need help and so forth. So,
You need a place that you can always go to.
You need a place you can always go to, exactly. So I've never seen anybody even dream about giving up their U.S. citizenship unless they had another citizenship that they felt comfortable with.
I actually know one or two. Yeah, incredibly. So, I wouldn't advise it, but...
No, of course not. But the State Department cannot deny you your ability to renounce simply because you say, well, no, I don't have another citizenship. They will tell you that's foolhardy, maybe, but they can't deny you the ability to renounce your U.S. citizenship for that reason.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I'm just kind of going down some of the points you and I have discussed in the past. Mm-hmm. So I'm ready to move to the next one.
Well, I think it's worth one thing we haven't sort of stated clearly in this conversation is that renunciation of U.S. citizenship has to take place outside the United States. And they're going to take your passport.
I said you have to go to a consulate or embassy outside of America.
Okay.
Or otherwise, if you're in the States, which it won't happen, but then you would illegally be in the States because you don't have a U.S. passport. You know, you might not have a 90-day visa waiver program. You might not have another citizenship where you've gotten a visa. I mean,
aren't you simply illegally in the United States? I mean, if you were to say walk into New York City and renounce and that you walk out, you're not a U.S. citizen. I mean, you got no status at all, do you?
I don't know. I mean, let's take, for example, the dual national who might be a Swiss citizen as an example. The Swiss have a 90-day visa waiver program with the United States. So the Swiss citizen might need an ESTA to go in, but I don't think an ESTA number is mandatory. You don't need a visa to be in the U.S. if you have the protection of a visa waiver program, such as the Swiss do with the United States. So that person who goes into the U.S. and renounces, which I don't even think that's possible, but let's just say it could happen, and he leaves the U.S. as a non-U.S. citizen, I don't think he was there illegally.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. Interesting question. All right.
That's not based in reality, so...
Yeah. So onto the tax thing here. So let's begin with what is the impact? What does the Internal Revenue Code say about renunciation? What impact does it have on the U.S., the whole U.S. tax scene?
I think the important point is if we go back to one of the issues we've seen. Do you need to be U.S. tax compliant to give up your U.S. citizenship?
Yes or no?
The strict answer to that is no, you don't. You can still give up your U.S. citizenship. The State Department cannot say to you, you can't give up your U.S. citizenship. But what that does mean from a tax standpoint are a few things. First of all, just because you've given up your U.S. citizenship and you have not been tax compliant does not erase the past. It doesn't fix your tax noncompliance. So the US can still come after you for your tax noncompliance during the period when you were a US person. The other thing that it impacts is if you are not tax compliant for the 5-year period prior to the expatriation, then you, will be treated as a so-called covered expatriate if you cannot certify your tax compliance to the U.S. Internal Revenue Service on Form 8854. And we have a lot of issues where in the ideal world, you will tell your client, look, let's get all of your tax filings fully correct, fully updated, full tax compliance, prior to the date you go in and take the oath of renunciation at the embassy. So we'll have a totally clean slate before you expatriate. That is the ideal situation, because if everything is hunky-dory with the tax returns for the 5-year period, then that person on the date of his renunciation has been fully tax compliant and the IRS can never say to him, oh, you will be treated as a so-called covered expatriate because you were not tax compliant. In the real world, we don't always have that ideal situation. Some people will come to you and say, oh, I gave up my citizenship last month and I just read somewhere on the internet that I should have been tax compliant and filed tax returns. And I haven't filed. I haven't done this. I haven't done that. So then the question becomes, is that person going to be treated as a covered expatriate because on the date of his renunciation, he was not fully tax compliant? My view on that is you have room to argue that so long as you become fully tax compliant before you sign that form 8854 that asks, have you been fully tax compliant? Then you have an argument that if you fix up your returns and everything else, pay all your taxes, pay any penalties, before you sign that Form 8854, then you have an argument you should not be treated as a covered expatriate.
Virginia, I would know that the statute itself, 877A, absolutely does not require the 5 years of tax, or it's 877. Okay, 877, but the point is that the language of the statute does not require tax compliance at the point of renunciation, where interestingly, the net worth thing, which I'm sure you're going to talk about in a minute, is crystallized as of the date of renunciation, right?
That's right. John, the reason this is an area of concern is because we have so little guidance from the IRS on this renunciation topic. The only guidance we really have, there are no Treasury regulations issued under these statutory code sections. The guidance we have is in the form of an IRS notice. 2009-85 is the IRS notice number. It's very, very long. I've read that thing thousands of times. I'm sure you have as well. And nowhere in there is it clearly stated that you have to be fully tax compliant on the date of the renunciation in order to escape covered expatriate status. But I will tell you, in my discussion with the drafter of that form, that IRS notice, he said, oh, that's our view. You need to be compliant on the date you expatriate. I'm like, well, where's that in the notice? He's like, oh, it's in there. Well,
I think more significantly, it's not in the governing statute.
It's not in the statute. It's not clearly stated in the notice. Yeah. So, you know, we would take the position and argue it with the IRS if challenged, that so long as you fixed everything prior to, you should be fine prior to filing the Form 8854.
Well, so Virginia, another point that I think might be made here is, let's imagine that somebody renounces on, say, January 10th, 2022. There is no possibility that they can be compliant for the 5 years if the 5 years are 20, include, which obviously include 2021, right? You could not be compliant on the date that you renounced logistically because there's no way to file until like the third week of January or something, right?
Mm-hmm. I see your point.
Yeah.
I'll have to think about that more carefully.
Well, of course, from a practical point of view, I mean, look, let's be practical here. Obviously, all people who do this kind of work would prefer their clients to be tax compliant on the day they renounced. Agreed?
Of course, of course. And that's what we should do.
If they're not,
sometimes it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Right?
And if you just get them compliant. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the 8854, if you look at the exact language of the certification, it's just that they met the requirements for the 5 years. There's no, even in the form itself, there's no particular mention of the a requirement of time, right? Of when it was done. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You made me lose my trend of thought, John.
I mean, the second issue would be the 2 million net worth, and say somebody meets the 2 million, does that guarantee they'd pay an exit tax?
Oh, before we get into that, John, I remembered my train of thought. So we were talking about being tax compliant for the 5 years prior to expatriation. You may be aware the IRS is now coming to realize people don't know they need to file a Form 8854. And they've had this special procedure recently, I think about a year ago, which came in saying, if you didn't file a Form 8854, you can fix that up and not be a covered expatriate. If you carefully read all of the information the IRS has put out there on this special initiative, there is a section that says, you know, if you need to amend your tax returns, it sounded like that could be done as well. I've never had that case, but it seems to me the IRS might be becoming a little bit more realistic about this whole area of full tax compliance, filing the Form 8854, and expatriations. What do you think?
Oh, you know, absolutely. That's the procedure you're referring to is called the relief procedures for former citizens. And it actually was introduced, I think it was September of 2019. And, you know, I mean, I think it's great. I've certainly had occasion to use it with a lot of people. You know, there are requirements on it, like you've never filed a tax or a U.S. tax return, et cetera. You have to be below the $2 million. And they're actually forgiving up to $25,000 of U.S. tax, which is, because it's not clear to me where the statutory authority to do that comes from, but okay. I mean, it's great. That's another point I think that would support the conclusion that you don't have to be tax compliant on the date of renunciation, because if you did as a matter of law, it doesn't seem to me that, you know, that program.
The IRS could override that.
Yeah. But for listeners, that is a great program. It really is. Social Security numbers required.
If they can fit within the parameters, it's amazing.
Yeah, and no Social Security numbers required to use that either.
Yes, It was geared really for the accidental American, and we know that there were many of them out there, and hopefully if any of them are listening, they will look further into this process and see if they can get out scot-free.
Absolutely right. And the proof on that, just one other point on that, is that it's for people who relinquish U.S. citizenship after March 18th, 2010, which is a very significant day. That was the day FATCA was introduced, right? March 18th.
Yes.
But okay, continuing on here.
Right. What were you asking about, John?
The I guess the other issue would be the net worth, right? Well, actually, I think we can probably dispense with U.S. tax liability of an average of over $170,000 for most people, right? Or at least most people in my part of the world, you know, where there are high income taxes. Maybe not in your part of the world where there are no income taxes.
Right. I've never had that problem. Mine is always the 2 million net worth test that my clients struggle with.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's talk about the 2 million net worth test. How's that work? And what's the big issue that you see?
Okay, well, in order to escape this covered expatriate status, another one of the tests you have to satisfy is that your net worth at the day before the expatriation date, to be precise, cannot be $2 million or more. And by net worth, they mean all of your worldwide assets minus all of your worldwide liabilities. So you get to that net worth number and hope for the best. Now they are looking at the fair market value of the assets on the day before the renunciation date. And just as an aside, the reason they chose the day before the renunciation date as the date where you assess the net worth is to make sure there's no escape under perhaps some kind of treaty or something. So people have to just be aware that it is technically the day before the renunciation date that you assess the net worth. There are things people can do, of course, to try and get their net worth below the $2 million. Gifting is often used as a way to reduce net worth. That has to be done very carefully. I've seen many mistakes made in this area. But essentially, yeah, you just have to make sure your net worth is below the $2 million mark. And you need to make sure that the tax advisor who is helping you is being very, very careful with the assessment of the net worth. You know, do you have a foreign pension plan, for example? What's that valued at? An annuity. You know, you have to be very careful with these things. So I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that, John.
Well, in my part of the world, the pensions are always the big problem, right? Because if you get over the $2 million and a good chunk of that value is in a pension, for example, teachers in Ontario have very lucrative pension. Anybody who wants a good pension, become a teacher, I think is probably the answer. But, you know, if you're a covered expatriate, the way that type of thing is taxed is, you know, you speak of the day before renunciation. The commuted value of the pension is treated as distributed on the day before you renounce, which means that, you know, somebody could have like $1 million income in collusion, you know, the day before.
For the foreign pensions, it's horrible. It's just horrible.
It's unbelievable. I mean, confiscation. Yeah.
And the difficulty is people can't gift away their pensions. Okay. So they can't reduce the net worth by gifting away the pension. And they also have an issue in terms of maybe they can say, well, I'll try and cash it out and get my money and I'll gift the money away to get me below the 2 million. But in a lot of the cases I dealt with, they couldn't get the money out. You know, it's according to the pension plan rules.
Well, or they get it out, it's a huge tax cost. It's a huge tax cost, right? I mean, you know, to give an idea of how serious of a problem this is, you know, you could lose 40%. You could be required to pay a tax of 40% of the value of pension without any money to even pay the tax, right?
That's right.
This is incredible stuff. Absolutely shocking.
What other things have we seen that are wrong or questionable or needing clarification in some of the articles we've read?
Well, the pervasive
thing. I think you've just hit on the big thing, John, about the exit tax.
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of simple fact, to be subject to the exit tax, a lot of people will write that, you know, if you're over the 2 million or whatever, you will pay an exit tax. That's not necessarily true. To be subject to the exit tax does not mean that an exit tax will be paid. And there are multiple reasons for this. Why don't we explore some of the reasons?
Well, the reason that I see most often is because we have a certain exemption amount, which is indexed for inflation.
And that's about 700,000, right? Somewhere in that
range. Yes, I think it's around 760 something now for 2022. So when you expatriate and you are possibly a covered expatriate, you're treated as if you sold everything on the day before you've given up your citizenship. And you will have, of course, pretend gain on this pretend sale. So the 700 and something dollar exclusion amount allows you to exclude your gain, but it's not a simple calculation where you say, oh, I had $750,000 of pretend gain and I have a $750,000 exclusion amount under the exit tax rules, so therefore I know I don't owe any exit tax. It's not that simple. This 700 plus thousand exclusion amount, you must allocate it according to the various assets you have. And that's according to specific formulas.
It's prorated. Well, you know, the pension, by the way, interestingly, the taxation of the pension, to go back to that example, there's no $700,000 exemption on that. So the $700,000 exemption is only capital property.
That's correct.
You can tell, I'm obsessed with pensions, you know, because that's what's going on in this part of the world.
Understandably.
Another reason why people wouldn't pay a gain is because there is no gain. For example, it's very, very common for people to be able to ensure they take advantage of foreign tax credits. They'll actually sell all their assets prior to expatriation. And, so they owe a U.S. capital gains tax on that, which can often is, well, if they do that, it's because it's going to be offset by foreign tax credits.
Yes. Good planning. Yeah. That's the point, John. Good planning. So, for example, right in line with what you're talking about is the sale of the principal residence. If you sell your principal residence, you can have $500,000 gain exclusion amount if you're married filing a joint return. So the couple that's expatriating as a couple can sell their residence before they expatriate and get to use that exclusion amount. It's not clear that you can use that exclusion amount when you're calculating the exit tax if you haven't actually sold your property beforehand. So you're deemed to sell your home, and it's not clear that you're going to get this exclusion amount applied when you're calculating the gain. So if you have good planning, there are certain things you can do to reduce the exit tax, if not eliminate it.
Yeah, it can definitely be reduced. No question about that. The statute itself, as you can tell, I'm obsessed with the statute. The statute itself actually contains language that would preclude the use of the Section 121 capital gains exemption. So that's a problem. And if I'm not mistaken, I did notice 2009.
We weren't convinced. So you may have changed your mind about that statutory language.
I may have, or I may be wrong. But,
whatever. It's not crystal clear, definitely. Okay? You have an argument if you've messed up and you want to try.
But, if you want safe harbors, and I think most people want safe harbors, what is very clear is that if the principal residence is sold before the renunciation, you get the benefit
Absolutely.
Of the 50 or the 500. So why not just take it?
Well, because sometimes, John, in the real world, people live in their principal residence and they're remaining there. So they don't want to sell it.
Oh, my God.
I mean,
people's lives aren't completely driven by avoiding the exit tax.
No, unfortunately, they need a place to live.
I didn't know that. God, I'm always glad to do these discussions with you to keep me grounded. Okay. Now, you know, we talk about, yeah, so we talk about the planning on this. One other point that you made, you know, you talk about the gifting. What's your view of whether gifts should be made in the year prior to expatriation or a year prior to expatriation?
Yeah, I'm a stickler on that, John. I'm obsessed with that. As I read the language in the Internal Revenue Code, you want to make sure that you are going to be entitled to use your, it's now currently 11.7 million, I think, lifetime exclusion amount when you're making gifts. So you want to be able to use that lifetime exclusion amount, and it's a big, big number if you're a US citizen. If you read the language pertaining to that lifetime exclusion amount in the gift tax rules, it talks about you're entitled to the amount of the exclusion that you have at the end of the calendar year. So it talks about the calendar year. And if you look at the end of the calendar year for someone who has expatriated in the same calendar year that he's made the gifts, okay, so you've got your guy, pretend he's expatriated, he's made his gifts in February of 2020, and he expatriates in April of 2020. If you look at the end of his calendar year, what is he entitled to for his exclusion amount? Is it the 11.7 million? The answer to me is no, because at the end of his calendar year, he's a non-resident alien, and those guys only get a $60,000 exclusion amount. So I'm a stickler that I want all gifts for your gift tax planning to be made in the year prior, at least in the year prior to.
Yeah. That's an interesting point, because this is not something that is commonly thought about.
No, and I see people, tax practitioners, making this mistake all the time, and then I kind of rain on their parade, and they want to hit me over the head because they don't know.
But if
you look at the language, and I always tell people, go to the code, go to the source, because that's, you know, at the end of the day, that's really what you need to rely on. Make sure the planning is done properly.
Well, I think one theme of this whole discussion is that this stuff really should be thought through on every level. You know, one thing we haven't mentioned, just sort of wrapping this up, is, you know, we've talked about the exit tax implications of being a covered expatriate. I think it's probably worth mentioning the inheritance issues as well. Do you want to add that module to our discussion?
Of course, John, of course. Our discussion wouldn't be complete without talking about that.
It would not.
Torture. Okay, so if you're a covered expatriate, not only will you suffer with the exit tax, which we discussed, and certain more horrible things with your foreign pension plans, but any U.S. people that are involved in your close circle may also end up suffering if you are a covered expatriate. Now, how can that happen? It happens because we have a section of the Internal Revenue Code, section 2801, which says any U.S. person receiving a gift or a bequest from a covered expatriate has to pay to the IRS whatever the maximum gift and estate tax rate is at the time on that gift or bequest. So if you're a covered expat, we'll take an example. You're a covered expat. You give a gift of $1 million to your US citizen daughter. Under that transfer tax rule that I mentioned, she has to pay the current tax rate, which is maximum 40%, on her covered gift from you, the covered expatriate. So that means she gets $1 million gift. She's got to pay over $400,000 to the U.S. Internal Revenue Service as her punishment.
Oh, my God. Do you think that might encourage whole families to renounce U.S. citizenship?
It's the only way to fly.
That's incredible. All right. Well, this has been...
I have a blog post on that if people want to know more. Remember now, these rules came in 2008, we still do not have regulations other than proposed regulations on this transfer tax issue we have discussed. The proposed regs came out in 2015. We're still waiting 6 years later. They've not been finalized. But I did see very recently, about a month and a half, 2 months ago, max, the IRS had issued something saying what their important priority projects are. And this 2801 regulations was on there. So we may see some action on that.
Well, means even more roads lead to renunciation. That's, you know, that's, yes, that's really crazy. I mean, it's a reversal of the normal rule of gifting.
And the frightening thing, John, with the proposed regulations we saw in 2015, the burden of proof is on the U.S. recipient of the gift or bequest to prove that the person, the covered expat, the individual who gave him this gift or bequest, he has to prove that that person was not a covered expatriate. So I keep thinking in the real world, let's say someone gives up their citizenship in 2009 and they die in 2022 or 2023 and they're not a covered expatriate. So they leave a bequest of $1 million to their US citizen child. The US citizen child must fill out a form 3520 part 4 to say they got an amount from a foreign estate of $1 million. And then that triggers the IRS to say, oh, let's check this out. Maybe that person they got it from was a covered expatriate. Mm-hmm. They will make that U.S. recipient of the bequest. The burden of proof will be on him to say, no, no, my mother was not a covered expatriate. Well, how do you prove that? How do you show that your mother was fully tax compliant for the 5 years prior to the expatriation date? That means you have to have her tax returns.
Absolutely. So what this means, Virginia, is that in addition to a will, that all wills of people who renounce should include a provision of leaving their tax returns and net worth statements on the date of renunciation to their heirs.
You've got to have a file with that information along with your will. Absolutely. That's what I recommend to all my clients, and I check it. And I, in fact, always try and get the 5 years of tax returns sent to me from the IRS so that we have the little IRS stamp. Yeah, this is what was filed. This is what we have. So there's never an argument. Oh, well, maybe these aren't the ones that were filed with the IRS. This is just the taxpayer's copy. You get me? You get me?
Yeah. My God, what a world we live in. What a world we live in.
It's not an easy thing, John, but that's the sum and substance. So what started off as a short podcast has grown, as does everything with U.S. tax. You fall into the rabbit hole and you try and escape. It's not easy.
U.S. citizenship is a complex thing. I guess to whom much has been given, much is expected. Well, anyway, so Virginia, your coordinates, how would people find your blog and all that great stuff and your contact information? Right.
Okay, well, people should definitely go to my blog. I have a whole section on expatriation. They can look at the blog post categories and just click the button that says expatriation, and they can learn everything that they did or did not ever want to know on the topic. And my coordinate for my website and blog is www.us-tax.org.
And it is well worth reading. She is a legendary blogger, probably the only truly legendary blogger in the world of U.S. tax. So,
oh, I don't know about that, but my blogs have been going for a long, long time, and my tax Twitter account, which every week announces my latest blog post, has been named to Forbes top 100 must follow tax Twitter accounts every year since 2017.
And deserve it, though. And that's at VL Jeker, right? At VL Jeker. I recommend everybody follow it. Certainly I do.
Oh, thanks, John. That's most appreciated. Okay, well, this has been great, and look forward to our next discussion.
Likewise. Thank you very much. Stay warm.
I will. Thanks, John. Bye-bye.